right here on the bottom. And this is nice, especially when you take consider our set theoretic interpretation of the post-set relation. It was set inclusion. So if I'm looking for a set down here, which is a subset of everybody whose parent it is, the empty set is probably the only valid choice. Okay, so that's so maybe the empty set's a face, but that's the most boring one. If I move this supporting line all the way until it touches a vertex, well, that vertex we're also going to call it face of the polyhedron. So face in this context doesn't just mean two-dimensional. So really what it means is every element in this poset is a face. Sometimes also use the word cell to confuse you here. I mean the same thing. So that's what it means to be a face. And we also say, just as a convention, we're going to say that P is a face of itself. Yeah.
So is this definition of face, is this one, this face, the same as what we had before?
Well, not really. Before, when I used the word face for plane graphs, I meant to the two-dimensional objects. It happens to be that this is, in general, polyhedra, the word face is used. Because we ran out of words at some point. We said vertex, edge, face, then you gotta say something like maybe solid face, and then you wanna say what's the 40 thing. It's kind of tricky, right?
So rather, this one is, one of these elements of the...
Yes. These are all sets, yeah, so the elements of this partial iterator set. Now, a post-set doesn't have to be a polyhedron, but a polyhedron is going to be a post-set, and we're going to prove that. It's going to have, I shouldn't say it is a post-set, it at least has a post-set structure when you look at the faces. We do have this one convention that P is a face of itself, and that corresponds to this top. So at least in the case of polyhedra, right, that's where we stick P itself, right on the top. And it should be clear that every face in the poset, every face as defined here, every polyhedron, is going to be a subset of the polyhedron itself, because the faces are defined to be the intersection of that polyhedron with something else, with some hyperplane.
Intersection and can be one of the statements of the polyhedron.
It can also be an edge?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so that's why it could be any dimension. So here we have the empty set was definitely a face. The full polyhedron is a face. Let's just do this example. Mm-hmm. We see that any vertex can easily be made into a face. You just, any vertex on the convex hull. I guess we're assuming that that's all we have here. There's no vertices sitting on the lines. Okay, so, pretend this one goes through. So these are all supporting hyperplanes, because remember again, a hyperplane in the plane is a line. It's D minus one dimensional, and 2D, that's a one dimensional thing, it's just a line. So I get all the vertices this way for this polygon, and if I also look at supporting lines that are parallel to the edges, I find that the intersection of this line with the polygon is just the edge. So that gives me the empty set, all the vertices, all the edges, and the polygon itself. So I don't I only have three levels. Is that clear? Any questions? I will have one other definition, which is a facet. So not a face, but a facet. of a polyhedron is a face of codimension one. Codimension is D minus the dimension. So it means it's a D minus one dimensional face. And that's pretty good. Let's just check a couple things. First of all, I think that this does have a close-set structure. If I look at all the faces, there is a natural partial order on the faces, which is just set inclusion. Because these faces are sets. It's actually the intersection of a convex set with a hyperplane, which is also a convex set. Intersection of convex sets is convex. So they're nice convex sets. And I claim that this has a close-set structure. So let's just check in this case. You can see that if I look at, an edge contains both of the endpoints. And that's true for all the edges. And the entire convex polygon contains all the edges. And that's it. That's all we have to check in the case of a polygon. Just shows that the containment from one dimension down to the next dimension is satisfied. Okay, so sometimes. I guess we're gonna need one more. I'm going to say that when we take this whole collection of polyhedra, we can take a set of polyhedra. It's called a polyhedral complex. That's closed under taking boundary. Set K polyhedra if K is closed under taking say boundaries, but I mean faces. So if I have a polyhedron, I should just check here. I assume it was clear, but maybe we should just be explicit. The faces of a polyhedron, are themselves a polyhedra. Does everyone notice that? You can check that it satisfies the definition. Because a hyperplane is the intersection of two half spaces. Do that. A hyperplane has a half space on one side and half space on the other, and they both contain that hyperplane. So the intersection of those two half spaces is just the hyperplane. So a hyperplane is a polyhedron. The intersection, and so when I take a polyhedron and I intersect it with a hyperplane, I'm just adding two more half spaces into the intersection. So it's also the intersection of a finite set of half spaces. So faces are polyhedra. So a polyhedron plus all its faces is your set of polyhedra. And this close-set structure is just a close-set on the set of polyhedra. You can do something even more novel, which is just take a set of polyhedra, and as long as that set also contains all the subfaces, I mean all the faces of all the polyhedra, then it's what we call a polyhedral complex. So the simplest example, let's just check, a polyhedron is a polyhedral complex. A polyhedron in all its faces is almost by definition, it's almost tautological here. This is forms a polyhedral complex. This is just check to make sure that you believe that. But it's, like I said, it's almost a tautology, so it's just like rewriting the definition, and it's the simplest case. And so now we can again revisit something we saw in 2D with a little bit more generality, because we can look at certain cases of the planar straight line graphs we saw as not just as planar straight line graphs, but some of them are actually polyhedral complexes. We'll need some more definition here, and then we can draw some pictures and have some fun. For a polyhedral complex, K, the underlying space it's written with these vertical bars, and it means the union of all the polyhedra in the complex. And we have to be a little careful because the other condition, this first definition is purely combinatorial. It just says, like, it's a collection of sets, and here's the condition on what sets must be in this collection of sets in order for it to satisfy this definition. There's also a geometric condition, which we'll virtually always include, which is that that there's some intersection properties between this. That, what I mean is that, I'll write this as a comma, and for any pair of polyhedra in this set, their intersection has to be nice in the following way. P1 intersect P2 has to be equal to either the empty set or a common face of P1 and P2. Let's just draw some examples that this geometric condition disallows. A line segment is a polyhedron. If I take the line segment and its two vertices, that's a polyhedral complex, a nice simple one. If I have another line segment and its two vertices, that's also a polyhedral complex. I can't just take the union of these two and call that a polyhedral complex because I have two polyhedra, namely these edges, and their intersection is not empty, and it's not a face of these two edges, right? The face of this edge, the faces of this edge are the vertices, and the faces of this edge are these two vertices. And neither of those is this intersection point. Okay. This is the combinatorial condition, this is the geometric condition. It says that we drew it nicely. So let me give you a really fantastic example we will learn to love, which is not new for this class, it's a triangulation. So if you think about this triangulation, we thought of it as a planar straight line graph. But you can also think of it as a polyhedral complex. The triangles are all polyhedra. You can include all the triangles, the vertices, and the edges at a straight line graph. And because these are nice convex, the two-dimensional faces here are nice and convex, this is actually a polyhedral complex. And there are things that really would not count as a triangulation if they broke one of these rules. Like, for instance, if we did the following. I have to decide which triangles, even though it's possible to draw this as a plane of straight line graph. Right, I take this guy and I move it in here, and instead I'll get no crossings and I'll have a nice planar straight line graph.
How are you supposed to compensate?
It is if you draw it correctly, right? So the point is, at least for planar graphs, this intersection condition is capturing our, well, before we were using as our condition on being a drawing. Right, the drawing rule said that the edges have to intersect somehow nicely. And remember the specific conditions on the edges? It said what? They have to intersect at a common endpoint. Well, that's exactly this condition, but limited to the one-dimensional case. Right? And so once you realize that a line segment is a polyhedron, and you should check that. You should believe that a line segment is a polyhedron. And you can see that if I just look at the edges and vertices of a graph, of a planar straight line graph, that is a polyhedral complex. So let me do that one as my next nice example for you to check. Think about. So just the edges and vertices of a PSLP. Form a so I gave this definition that for a polyhedral complex K, if I take the union of all the polyhedra, that's the underlying space, and that allows me to say that now a decomposition, in fact I'll say maybe it's not necessary, but I'll say it like this. The decomposition of the space X is a polyhedral complex whose underlying space is X. If I looked at this, I'm sorry, I write space here, I just mean a set. That's the topologist in me talking here. So in this case of this triangulation I drew, if I looked at this, the convex closure of these points, this triangulation is a decomposition of the convex closure. Maybe that's worth writing down. In fact, that's what we're even going to call a triangulation of a plane set. A triangulation of a plane set. This is the notation for the underlying space.
Oh.
Sorry, that's a, I've overloaded the vertical bars notation. I apologize, that was confusing. But it's necessary, right, for this as well, that the underlying space of the complex is the set that you're decomposing. Okay, the other condition we need to be a triangulation is just that they're all triangles. For now, we can think of this as in the plane, R2, and I'm using this notation two-phase just to point out what the dimensions here. The faces are just defined as sets, but when I talk about their dimension, I hope it was clear that I really mean the dimension of their that affine closure. It's the it's a line segment, it's the dimension of the line to that line segment. It's a one-dimensional thing, two-dimensional things are two-dimensional. I know that this was a hard part of the homework. I think I'll have time to talk some more about it at the end. Okay, so what's good to know about triangulations? One is that they exist. We did do one existence problem like this, right, for triangulations of polygons. Let me just give you a very, very simple constructive proof that if I give you a point set in the plane, there at least exists a triangulation. And for now, let's just do it in general position. Well, it's very hard to draw points in general position. So there's we know that there's a convex hull. We can find that. We know that this is a simple polygon, so it can be triangulated. And now, okay. So this isn't the right definition that I've drawn here. But it occurs to me that this definition is more general than it needs to be, because technically this is now a triangulation of a point set. There is another condition you might expect, which is that the set of zero faces, we'll make this a real condition, the set of zero faces is P. So for now, when we talk about triangulation, we're not allowed to add any other vertices. And so this isn't quite done, even though this is a triangulation, and the underlying space is the convex closure, and all the two faces are triangles, but we haven't actually touched all the points. So the way to finish this, we have step one, was take the convex closure, or convex hull. Step two was triangulate the convex hull. And then third, we're just going to, for each point, it's in a triangle, one at a time, since it's inside a triangle. And we know it's inside a triangle because what? Every point that's left is inside the convex closure, and the convex closure is is equal to the underlying space of the complex, and so it lies in the complex, so it's in some face of the polyhedral complex, and, well, assuming general position, it's going to be in a two-dimensional face. It's not going to lie on a line set. So you can just take any point, it's in a triangle, and you can just split that triangle three ways. And you can do this recursively, and this will give you an algorithm. Which already shows you that a triangulation exists. It may not be a good one, depending on what you want to use it for. But at least shows that there's some triangulation of that other point set. This is always true. Let me just write that. Split triangle three ways. So we actually have triangulations that exist, and this is another case where we have all of the pieces in place here to make the same definition and just lift it up into any number of dimensions. Okay, so to change this to be RD, so this is right on top here. So if I was looking at a point set in RD, I'd be looking at the D face, the D faces, and I would still have this requirement. And voila, I give you something that's a simple two-dimensional thing, and now I have a D-dimensional definition. This is triangulation. In higher dimensions, sometimes we don't... Oh, I have to be careful about this, sorry. A D-face can't really be a triangle. It has to be simplex. If you ever wondered what the three-dimensional triangle is, the answer is it's a tetrahedron. Ever wondered what a four-dimensional triangle is, that means is it's really just the convex closure of 5 points. So it's simplex, this definition down. Simplex, in fact, the definition, the dimension on it, the K-simplex is the convex closure of k plus 1 points in general position. Okay, so the example par excellence for k simplex is the 2 simplex, which is just a triangle. Okay? A 2 simplex is the convex closure of 3 points, i.e., it's a triangle. And a 3 simplex is the convex closure of 4 points. So there are 4 points, and as long as they're not all on one plane, then you get a tetrahedron. They're going to take their convex closure. And now you can talk about these kinds of simplices in higher dimensions. You just take one more than the number of dimensions, and that gives you a simplex. And so we will not change this word, though. We'll still call these triangulations. People might start calling them hyper-triangulations, or in 3D, start calling them tetrahedralizations. Or tetrahedralizations, and no one can figure out how to spell that or say it. So we're not going to do that, we're going to call them triangulations. So I want to spend a good chunk of the course on triangulations, but I think you probably need a little bit of time to digest this. How about some questions? And want to talk about this stuff? Does this seem reasonable? Blowing your mind a little bit, too easy, too hard? Any comments at all? Otherwise, I'm going to switch over to the homework problems.
It's too hard.
It's too hard, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll just give you a minute.
So what is the goal here? What are we trying to achieve? What are the fundamental problems?
Yeah, so there are a bunch of problems in computational geometry which deal with finding triangulations of point sets and talking about triangulations of point sets, or duals of triangulations of point sets. And so when we cover them, we're going to cover them not just in as for two-dimensional problems, but for any number of dimensions. So this kind of gives us the right vocabulary to be able to make these statements, but also so that when we talk about the 2D thing, the change from 2D to D dimensions is trivial. This is very easy. Yeah.
Why is the dual of triangulation important?
I think we're just gonna have to wait and see. In some ways, there's a particular triangulation. I'll just give you a hint. There's one called the Galois triangulation. And in many ways, its dual is more important than the triangulation itself. Like, the dual, like, was discovered, rediscovered many times throughout history, everyone from Descartes to whoever, reinvented the dual of the Galois triangulations, although they don't get their name on it. We will see that's important. And also, this structure automatically tells us that, I guess we don't know enough. I was going to say that we'd like to say immediately that we know that the dual of the triangulation is also a polyhedral complex. You can think about that one, so that's a good question. Any other question? All right. Alright, so I'll switch over to talking about some of these homework problems that were a source of much consternation, pain, and suffering. And let's start erasing this. Everyone cool with that? Easier or harder, depending on how you try to write the definition of a line. Here's what I think of. So it's true that a line in the plane, is a set of all solutions to a single linear equation. There's also a parametric version of a line. You've seen this? It's the easiest way to describe a line once you have two points on a line. So if I have a line through two points, say A and B, then this line, the set of all points, U such that what? Just that there exists T in one, where U equals 1 minus, oh, no, sorry, this is TR. 1 minus TA plus TB. Okay, you can call this the parametric version. You can also just say it's a set of all affine combinations of these two points. I mean, so the reason I call it the parametric version is that for any point T, you plug it in, you get a point U, which is a point on the line. And I think what happens is if you pick 0, you get point what, A. Pick 1, you get B. If you get 2, you get something like this same distance over here. This would be A plus 2B. Is that right? Right, so you start walking in this direction. I think of this as a function from a variable T to the line, and then if I take negative numbers, I start moving up in this direction. So once you write a line this way, this problem I think is pretty easy because the claim was first, so if A, B, and C are collinear, that really means that C is the point that you can write this way. That means C is equal to what? T, or 1 minus T, A plus TB. Okay, so for some T, right? So we know T, but T actually now that's going to tell us that if we just write T, A1 plus 1 minus T, B1, it's going to equal to what? So this is three linear equations. The first two variables in each of these vectors is giving us two linear equations, and then there's a third linear equation. So the first two linear equations are just saying this, and the bottom is saying that what? Well, yeah, T plus 1 minus T down here. The T plus 1 minus T is just 1. This. And so this is a linear dependence between these vectors. If you wanted to, you could like shuffle this around, but it doesn't really matter. It's true now that T A1 plus 1 minus T B1 minus T1 equals 0. So I have a linear dependence between these vectors. So that's one direction. To go the other way is also pretty easy. Again, just get back to this version. So if these vectors are linearly dependent, that means if there exists some alpha, beta, gamma, such that alpha 1 plus beta 1 0, then this is, again, three linear equations. You just pull them apart, and what you get is first, if you try to, if you take the first two equations and just isolate C, you get that C is alpha over negative gamma A plus alpha, or plus beta over negative gamma B. And you also get that from the last, from the third equation, you get alpha over negative gamma plus beta over negative gamma equals 1. So this is almost good enough. This says that what? You have C is written, actually, this is good enough. This is C written as an affine combination. This is a linear combination. This means it's affine. So C is an affine combination of A and B, that is to say, if I wrote T, T equals beta over 1 minus gamma, it's exactly in this form. Right, so that implies A, B, and C are collinear. And so it's just very simple algebra, just kind of picking apart sequence of linear these linear equations and just showing, interpreting them as vectors, interpreting them as points. Just to get you some facility in going back and forth. I'm going to skip 1.2 for now, because it's kind of the same. You do this the same now with another variable, and you find, for instance, that the 2D things, if they're coplanar, you can do exactly the same. And then if you have collinear points in 3D, you can do it one of two ways. One is you can just, again, do this. It's the same rearranging the coefficients. Or you can try to look at how the line in 3D is the intersection of two planes. All right, so let's jump to the more interesting one. So 2.1 and 2.2, I apologize, these were a little, they probably looked a little circular, and I realized only afterwards what I really meant, because it was a bit strange in that the first pair uses the second definition, and the second pair uses the first definition. So you want to say, like, well, which one should I use? And here's what I assumed people would do, and this was, I should have been explicit, is that you use the definitions I gave in class, and then prove the equivalences independent of each other, 2.1 and 2.2. So let's do 2.1. I want to show that convex closure of U, that is to say, when I say that this convex closure, I know we're actually defining here, but I really mean the as I defined it in class. So it's the set of all convex combinations. It's the closure under the operation of taking convex combinations. So this is the set of all convex combinations of points in U. We want to say that it's equal to the intersection of all convex sets V that contain U. That's what this problem is really asking for. I show that these two different concepts actually coincide. So there's two directions to prove like when you have equivalence of two big sets, like 9 times out of 10, you always prove it the same way. You prove it by showing that one set is included in the other, and that this set, the other, is included in the first. So you don't do equivalence, you kind of do double inclusion. It's not too hard to show inclusion of one set in another. And you just pick an arbitrary element in the first set, and then prove that satisfies the conditions to be in the second set. Then you do the reverse. Okay, so let's do one little observation, which is that you can check this, but I assumed it was obvious, but I realized it's worth proving. The convex closure of U is convex. Now, that may seem, maybe it was obvious, but then when you do it, it may seem, start to seem not obvious. The point is that you take a convex combination of things, and you take convex combinations of those things that were convex combinations, but you can combine convex combinations into convex combinations of the original things. It's true, you can check it, and proof is a one-liner. But since that's true, since this is convex, then this is one of these sets. So if...
Then you have said that these two statements are equivalent. So I have, prove this one.
Yeah, so this is my claim.
Yes, prove this one with respect to that one. It's convex. I let it, because you have already said it in one, that it is a convex.
So here, like I said, this is now just notational shorthand. This is the set of all convex combinations of U. And you're saying that I need to know what this is before I prove this statement?
No, I need it as a ground.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
Okay, I need it as a ground. This is a convex.
Yeah, so we can prove it if you like. The point is that if you have a convex combination of convex combinations, it means that you've got some just like this. We've got sort of a two-dimensional array of sets. So this is a convex combinations. Just by linearity, you can rearrange these to be a convex combination. For some solution of large n, take ij and one of n of this alpha ij, and you just have to check that these coefficients, these are the points, these are in the original set, and these coefficients really do sum to one. And they're all non-negative, because the alpha i's and the beta i's are all non-negative. Five to non-negative things are still non-negative. Non-negativity is easy to check that they sum to one. It's also not too hard. I think it does. Okay, so the point of that is just to allow us to say that, well, okay, this intersection of all the convex sets that contain U, well, this is a convex set, and it contains U. So this is the easy direction, right? This means that since this is convex, and trivially U is in the convex closure of U, check that one too, so it means X is in this intersection of convex U.
More than X?
Oh, sorry, I assume we just fix any, right, so fix any x in convex closure view. I didn't put the conclusion here. We're going to pick any point in the second part. I'll just write like this. So if x is in here, it implies that x is also in convex closure view. Okay? Since I picked any point over here, I show that it was also in... So I picked any point on the left-hand side, I show it's also on the right-hand side. What I've proven here is that this is a subset of this. Okay, now we have to do the converse. This was the easy direction. Once you see that this is convex, it has to be in there. So conversely, suppose you picked just some point in the convex closure. And since by definition, there's some convex combination of points in U that gives us X. So let's write it. So X is equal to.
Sorry, I'm locked the board.
I'm over there. The sum of alpha I, pi, I equals 1 to n, where the pi's are all in U. The sum of the alpha i's is 1, and all the alpha i's are greater than 0. Let's say greater than blue. Okay, so let V naught be any convex set containing U. Okay, so I pick any old set that contains U. So really, I'm picking any old set in this intersection, any convex set. And we know that it's convex, and so like I said, we're going to use the definition we had in class. So that means that V naught is actually equal to the convex closure. And so that implies that these set the points pi are also in V naught.
Can we not say this? Yeah. Out of these, the intersection of V, right? So one of, say for example, we have any number of V's. So one of these V's is CCU itself.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, so find out the fixed point.
If the intersection, so that point does not belong to the intersection, then that point does not belong to CCU also, which is not possible.
That's cute. Is that true? So you're saying if it's intersection.
The point which belongs to the intersection has to belong to all of the sets.
Yes.
Right. So, and one of the sets is CCU, which actually contains all the convex, combinations of the points belonging to U.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if it's the case that there is at least one V, there is one point which does not belong to one such V, and that's why it does not belong to the intersection, then there is one such element which does not belong to the intersection, then there has to be at least one V which does not contain that element.
Yeah, so I am afraid you may have just proven this first part again by the contrapositive. Is that really going to give us this the other inclusion? Because I want the inclusion that this is actually in the intersection.
Oh, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I tried to do that the first time, but the problem is that if you have one point outside, you can't guarantee that it's like, for me, it's, you don't prove like if you be in the intersection, if you be in the element, like. Okay.
I think this is the simplest thing to do is just to observe that this is a convex set, so it's one of the sets in the intersection, and so you get the inclusion in that direction. But now you want to get the inclusion the other way. You just go the other way and say, well, V naught is any convex set containing U, and since it's convex, it's equal to all the convex combinations. So all the PIs are in V naught itself. So when I write X, again, like X is equal to the sum of the alpha i's pi's. This is a convex combination of points in V naught. So this is an element of, right, which is equal to V naught. So it implies that X, so X in here implies that X is also in V naught. Now, I did this for any convex set. So this is true for every convex set, so it's true for the intersection. Okay, so we didn't make any assumptions about where V naught came from. Proved it for an arbitrary V naught. Okay, so it's right here, so X is in the intersection of the V naughts. And so that implies the other direction of this inclusion. Thank you. Good. Okay, so for the second one was way more interesting.
So the second one is like, you prove that one of the convex combinations, say for example, sum of is ITI, I running from 1 to n plus 1, can be represented by sum of, some XITI plus that stuff, like 1 minus t into that plus 1 minus t into some other point.
Yes, this is exactly the right idea. So you kind of have to use induction.
Yeah.
Everyone use induction? No? It's the right answer, use induction. Let me just rewrite what you're really trying to prove here. What suffices to show is that you have a set U, or all sets U, it's the case that if U is closed under taking convex combinations, which is convex combinations of some number of points, that that's true if and only if it's closed under taking combinations of just pairs of points. So I gave you the definition as closure of the convex combination operation, but you could also think of it as just taking the closure under convex combinations of pairs. So one of these is really strictly stronger than the other. So one direction of this proof should be really easy, and that's why Sir Dipton only gave me one direction. I'll just show you the whole thing. So you want to show that for all sets U, U is closed under convex combination if and only if U is closed under, let's say, line segments, which is really just convex combinations of pairs. Okay? All right, so the direction that's obvious is that, well, if it's closed under taking arbitrary convex combinations, then it's certainly closed under taking convex combinations of just 2 points at a time. The harder thing is to go the other way. And so, you want to show the following by induction on n. We'll show the following. AB is contained in U. So the line segment AB is contained in U for all AB in U. So this is being closed under line segments. Then for any x in the convex closure of U, x is also in U. Is it clear that that's good enough? U is a set that's closed under taking these pairs, and we'll show that it's equal to its convex closure. Yeah.
Is there any problem if, like, I consider the convex closure, like, with definition and with 2 points, like, so because of this, I did almost everything in 2.1, and in 2.2, it's usually 2.1.
Can you do it all in 2.1?
I define the convex closure like if I take two points that I take, these two points must be the convex combination of these 2 points must be in the set, like in the convex closure.
I have to look at it.
Okay.
Chances are, these problems are closely related enough that it's reasonable that you can shift some of the limits from one side to the other. Let me just give you this last bit here. It's exactly what Sudipta said. We're going to take this convex combination and write it as a point on some line segment in U. Right? And that will guarantee that it's actually in U. So what does that mean? It means that x was equal to some alpha I pi, where I equals 1 to n, where again pi is a nu, and the sum of the alpha i's is 1, and alpha I, I'm going to ask it to be strictly greater than 0. And the point here is that, well, usually convex combinations have to be non-negative, but if one of the coefficients is 0, I just won't include it, and I'll just have fewer points here. And in fact, if I have fewer than n points, then by induction I'm done. I let A equal Pn, let T equal alpha n, and let B equal to the sum from I equals 1 to now n minus 1 of alpha I over 1 minus alpha n Pi. So there's just a couple things to check. So this is a new point. I just picked out this new point, which is a convex combination of n minus 1 points in U. So by induction, it's also in U. So you have to check that this, in fact, is a convex combination. I'll just write that check, that the sum of alpha I over 1 minus alpha n is really equal to 1. But that implies that this is equal to is in U. And so now I have a point A in U, a point B in U, and I have the point X, which is equal to TA plus 1 minus TB. So X is in this line segment. So X is in U. That's all we know. I will maybe just note one thing here, which is that in question 3, I have a feeling that a lot of people wrote things which were way more complicated than they need to be, and some answers are probably not complicated enough. Let me just tell you what. In 3.1, if they're not all on a line, if they're not all just on a line, and there's actually only, you can do it with just 3 cases. And so if you like implemented a whole gram scan or something, it was really overkill. Because really, if you think about convex orderings of points, they could be A, B, C, D, or I guess I could reverse this so that's something like A, B, C, D. Well, if I always draw A up here, how many different cyclic permutations are there? I'm going to get 6, right? And if I account for symmetry, I only get 3. And so you just have to check for those 3 cases. And those are the only ways you can have 4 points in convex position. I think it was a little confusing because I clarified that if the points, if 3 of them are on a line like this, we were going to call this not in convex position, but I didn't mean that it was the definition of what it means to be not in convex position. Yeah, I know. I understand. It was ambiguous in the statement. All right, so that one should have been pretty simple, like four lines of code. Check if they're all, you know, eight lines. Yeah.
So if those things are collinear. Right. A, B, and C, then they are not in convex position.
We're going to say that convex position, they actually have to be sometimes all necessary in order to define the convex closure. So if this one is on the is a convex combination, the other one is somehow convexly dependent, points are not in convex position.
So for them, what I did is, if they're collinear, then I just rule out that case. Like,
yeah, so if it's immediately, you can answer no, right? If any of them are collinear.
There could be multiple solutions, right? I mean, for example, I did the gram scan, but in the end, I check if there's a point inside or collinear, then yeah. It will say return false.
I'm sure there's always like a million ways to write a program that will give the correct answer.
Wait, so what are you implying we're supposed to do?
The answer, well, it should have been, the only times you're supposed to return true is if they form a, like a convex quadrilateral with, for some order.
And we check that via Gram's scan?
No, I
or with what?
I'll actually go through the answer maybe next time, but I guess...
Well, I just checked if there's a point inside the other three for all four points.
Exactly.
That's good enough.
Yeah.
That works. So that's four cases instead of three.
Yeah. And then there's the one where you're checking zeros.
So the CCWs has to be equal.
Yeah, so I'll show you next time. I guess I have 1 minute to tell you why everyone, or many people were missed this last one, probably. There were really five interesting cases for the last one, where they actually intersect, where they don't intersect, where one of them has a point on the other one. And then there were these two degenerate cases, where they're both on the line like this, and the other one where they sort of overlap.
What about the one where there's like they're not intersecting, but there's a point parallel to the other ones?
I don't think that one's hard.
Factor in input.
Yeah, I think it comes out. I can write it. You're right. I guess technically that would be interesting as well. All of these can be done using almost exactly the code we did in class. In class, we said this CCW is equal to negative this other one, and change that equal negative to just be not equals, and it handles most of the degeneracies. And this one, you can't actually do with just CCW, because obviously all the CCWs you're going to do are going to give you the same answer for both of these cases. And so one thing you could do is to sort them by, say, their x-coordinate, or if they're all on a vertical line, you sort them by their y-coordinate, and then you can test for this kind of answer.
So, even if you see, only but I